the dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today on this second day of 2017.
Happy New Year.
Happy New Year with Sherry Antonetti, who is among the many people who survived 2016 without dying. So that's good.
That was the plan.
And I am also, at least so far, not dead, although things can always change. And I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today on this beautiful, still Christmas. It's still Christmas.
Three more days of Christmas.
But it's Christmas until, well, depending on who you talk to, some people extend Christmas, you know, the 12 days to Epiphany.
Yes.
Some of them take it to the baptism of the Lord. There are a few diehards out there who will, you know, take it all the way until February. I think those are mostly in Poland. I have some Polish listeners. I don't know if I have any Polish listeners, but if I do, and you're, you know, the diehard. I had a friend who lived in Krakow for a while.
Oh, wow.
And he was wandering around Krakow in February going, on the 40th day of Christmas.
Well, you know, I got to like that kind of thinking, you know, 40 days of Christmas, that works for me.
I'm down with that. Yeah. You know, especially if you could just like take all of January off.
Yes.
You know, and go to Florida or something like that.
And then you could start Lent in February, which is because February is bad anyway. So why not put Lent just there?
That's true. February is, for me, has always been, for a number of reasons, has been associated with the true bleakness of winter.
Yes.
The main reason, there are a couple of reasons. You used to be, when I was a kid, you still had both Washington's birthday and
Labor Day. Yes.
But then they got sick of giving people 2 days off in February. So they turned it into President's Day and just whittled it down to one. So I felt ripped off when they did
that. Yes, I agree. Why do you want fewer days off? I don't understand. Doesn't make sense to me, but okay.
But then the other thing about February was you had Valentine's Day, which for a long time was associated with, you know what? No woman would ever love you, Mark. That was only reinforced by the hideousness of the Sadie Hawkins Day dance.
Yeah.
The Sadie Hawkins Day dance was just a yearly reminder that no girl would ever ask me to a Sadie Hawkins Day dance. And so I hated February for years and years growing up. But then,
Jan, if you're listening, you have to ask Mark to a Sadie Hawkins dance now.
I've had the love of my life. Janet Shea, and all that's changed. And so now February is a happy time, and I get, and the nicest part about Valentine's Day for me is that it's not like the one day of the year where I'm reminded that Jan loved me, because she does that every day.
That is very.
And, so February has been redeemed. And so now January, I think, really is in the running for the bleakest month.
I gotta Christmas say February. We don't have any birthdays in February, which statistically is kind of an anomaly, in our family anyway. Well, so there's no cake in February, you know. Nothing to break the action.
I don't know, heart shaped, you know.
Yes. No, I don't. Well, Valentine's Day is the day. You know, February 13th is the day I run around like a crazy person trying to make sure we've got enough Hershey bars and heart-shaped stickers to get through five classrooms worth of Valentine's. So I'm about loved out by the time we get to February 14th.
Loved out. Yeah. So January, I mean, January, it's got one, you have Martin Luther King Day. So you do at least have one day off in January, and that's a nice thing. And plus you get to remember a great man. But still, you know, Christmas, I hold on to Christmas as long as I can.
Me too.
But Christmas is kind of, when the tree goes down on Epiphany, it's like, I suppose if I exercise sufficient imagination, I can carry it through to something further, but really Christmas just kind of ends on Epiphany for us. And then it's just, and then it's back to, you know, the realm of the White Witch, where it's always winter.
And I've heard Christmas. Yes. Oh, well said. Well said. Oh, yes. Yeah. Well, see, I now, growing up in Texas, we never got snow days. So I have the mild entertainment of hope that we will get a snow day here and there living in Maryland in February and in January. And that preserves my sense of sanity, because I don't like the long stretch without any holidays where we're off, where we stop running at the normal pace of everything. And that's what I miss in those 2 months. But having declared our universal loathing of February, I think we can move off this topic.
Okay. All right. And move on to other things, you know,
that we love.
Well, yes. Other bleak.
Welcome to the winter of our discontent meeting of predicting the dots.
Hey, for example, that would be the bleak day of winter. And you wrote me earlier today, partly because we're just trying to figure out, are we doing a radio show today? Yes, we are. I said, okay. As Commander in Chief of Connecting the Dots, it fell to me to make that call.
Thank you.
And so we're back on the air live, and since it's coming up, and one of the things that's been in the news, and so you wrote me today, yes, discussing this, and I thought it'd be interesting to talk about it, is simply, you know, the issue, you know, what, ever since Pharisees, who, it's interesting to me that when the Pharisees came to Jesus with the question of paying taxes to Caesar,
yes,
the question was not an abstract question in a seminar. Robert Benchley once said that there are two kinds of people in the world, those who divide the world into two kinds of people and those who don't. There are also, I say, two kinds of people in the world: those who ask questions to find things out, and those who ask questions to keep from finding things out. And the Pharisees were very much in the latter camp. The disciples of Jesus often come to him with real questions, questions that they actually want an answer to, because they wanted to know what's going on. And so you get people coming to him, you know, and saying, how often, when Peter asks, how often do I have to forgive somebody? He's asking a real question. He's asking because he wants to know. He thinks he knows the answer. You know, the teachers of the law said three times. Peter, being a magnanimous sort, said, well, how about seven times? And he thought he was going to, like, score brownie points with that question. But it was a real question, at least. He really wanted to get an answer from Jesus. And the answer that he got from Jesus was surprising to him, not seven times, but seven times 70 times. But when the Pharisees came and asked, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? They didn't care about the answer. What they were looking for was a way to nail him. And so the question, in their view, had no answer. He couldn't win, no matter what answer he gave. If he said no, then he was a traitor to Caesar, and they could have him busted on that. But if he said yes, then he was a traitor to Israel, and they could denounce him for that. And again, he gives them an answer which surprised them, which they weren't expecting. Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's, and unto God that which is God's. And in giving that answer, he not only stymied their attack on him, which is what that question was, it was a form of attack, but he also gave a real answer for the benefit of his listeners. And in a sense, he gave sort of marching orders to his church on how to deal with the relation of the sacred and the secular. That's, in other words, that Caesar has a real place in the world. Paul will elaborate on that when he writes Romans 13. And say that Caesar's got a real job, and it's given to him by God. I run into this is always on the internet. I seldom run into these people in real life, but on the internet, I run into libertarians a lot who are essentially anarchists, who claim that there is no place for the state anywhere. Everything should all be privatized, you know, that if we really put our minds to it, we could personally, you know, just get together on Saturday afternoons and build the interstate system and maintain it. And, are you there? I think we lost Sherry. Danny? Okay. So anyway, it fell to Caesar to have a real place, according to Paul in Romans 13. And Paul will even go so far as to say that Caesar's role in the world is given to him by God. So he will say that Caesar's authority comes from God. And that he has a place in the world to, maintain order and make sure that it's served. And we'll talk about that more when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti, and we'll be back right after this.
Dots.
is Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti. Sherry is back on the air.
I am.
Well, things are beautiful. Life is good. People are.
Yay.
And anyway, so when the Pharisees asked that question of Jesus, is it lawful to pay taxes to Caesar? The irony of the question is that it is itself a political act. It's not an abstract question. They're engaging in politics in the very act of asking the question because they're trying to get him in trouble.
Yeah, one way or the other, we're going to get you.
Yeah, and this question is asked in an incredibly politically charged environment. This wasn't asked early in Jesus's ministry, for example,
right.
When the Pharisees are still kind of making up their mind about him before opinion is hardened against him. This is a question that is asked after Jesus has ridden into Jerusalem on a donkey,
right.
in a fantastically politically charged act. It's hard for us to grasp how significant that act was because we're not familiar with the political background behind it, with the biblical background behind it. What happened was 1,000 years before the time of Jesus, when the great archetypal king of Israel is laying on his deathbed, he picks his own heir, Solomon.
Yes.
There's an argument about who gets to be David's heir. And David doesn't wait until he's dead and let it be hashed out. He picks his heir.
Right.
And the guy he picks is Solomon. And Solomon's brother tries to claim the throne, but this group of people around David rally to Solomon's cause. And then Solomon rides into Jerusalem, not on a war horse, like a king would do.
Right.
He rides into Jerusalem on a donkey.
Yes.
And the whole point of that gesture is, I'm coming to you as a servant king. I'm not going to lord it over you like Pharaoh.
Right.
So if you want to think, here's an analogy. Imagine in 2020 that some candidate, pick one at random, Marco Rubio.
Okay.
Shows up at Valley Forge wearing a powdered wig and a tri-corner hat and a frock coat.
Looking like he's in the cast of Hamilton. Okay.
Yes, exactly. And announcing that he's running for president. What does every American, who does every American recognize he is?
He's trying to, yes, with George Washington. Yes, it's symbolically, I am here. I am taking this mantle.
Right. And so when Jesus rides into Jerusalem on a donkey, he is, make no mistake about it, because nobody in that crowd did.
Yeah.
He's absolutely making a messianic claim when he does that.
Of kingship. Yes.
Sure. And not just any king, son of David. That's
yes.
who he identified
yes.
himself as. Because that's what the original archetypal son of David had done. That's
right.
what Solomon did. And so he's absolutely claiming to be Messiah. Everybody in the crowd recognizes that, which is why they're all yelling Hosanna to the son of David.
Yes, that makes sense. Okay.
And that's why the Pharisees are all saying, tell these people to shut up.
Yeah. Yes.
And that's... Jesus does not at that moment say, oh, well, this is a big understatement. I just
borrowed this donkey here right. for no reason. It just happened to be like this. Yeah, no.
I apologize. This is all a big misunderstanding.
Yes.
No, he says, if these people were silent, the stones would cry out. He is absolutely claiming to be the son of David.
Exactly.
That means he's making a claim to be the king of Israel and all the rest of it.
Yes.
And so when the Pharisees come to him 2 days later after this and ask him this supercharged question about whether it's lawful to pay taxes to Caesar, that's why all eyes are on this conversation, because everything is hanging on Jesus's answer. Is this
right.
actually make a subversive political claim? Is he actually going to say we shouldn't be paying taxes to Caesar?
Caesar, yes.
Because if he does, we will
we got them.
We're going to be over at the Roman Procurator's palace in 10 minutes.
I got a guy out the door right now, just waiting.
Paddle on this guy, right? That's what's behind the whole question, you know. So it's an intensely politically charged atmosphere. And by the way, if you're still unclear about that, just be sure to read the charges on the sign above his head a couple of days later.
Yes.
Because the charges are Jesus Nazarenus Rex Judaeorum, Jesus of Nazareth,
King of the Jews. Yes. And that's what Pilate asked him over and over again.
Are you the King of the Jews?
Yes.
That's what they want to know. And so the engagement, you know, you will hear people say things like Christianity should have nothing to do with politics. Well, sorry, but I mean, Christianity was born in a crucible that was completely charged with politics. And it's always had something to do with politics.
And Christianity can't be disengaged from how we care for everyone else. And that's what governments are designed to do. Unless you're an anarchist, the whole purpose of government is to protect the general welfare. Well, that's an outgrowth of, in a sense, Christian sensibilities in this country, that the idea that we're going to take care of our brother,
right?
And that, well, our word is our bond, you know, that we're going to do things to be good stewards of the environment or of, you know, the education, I mean, the instruction of the ignorant. All you can find all the acts that are embedded in our faith and what we're supposed to be about doing in the outreaches of what we try to do through the state. Now, do we do it well? No. But, you know, are we trying to? Yes.
Right.
You know?
So it's something that involves both our private acts. So we are personally called to, just as Christians, because we're disciples of Jesus, we're personally called to do the corporal and spiritual works of mercy. So it's up to you first.
Yes.
To be the person to, you know, feed the hungry, clothe the naked, give drink to the thirsty.
Yes. Bury the dead.
And all those things. And by the way, and also to do things which these days, even the works of mercy, some of them will get you in trouble.
Yes.
Some of them will always get you in trouble. So you know, admonishing sinners always get you in trouble.
Yeah.
Now, nobody likes to be admonished when they're a sinner.
It doesn't go over well. Yeah. it doesn't go over well with my own kids. You know.
No, nobody likes that.
You were wrong.
you'll hear things like blessed are the peacemakers. Well, that sounds great.
Until you actually have to do it.
Everybody hates peacemakers.
Yeah,
the common name for every peacemaker who's ever lived first is traitor.
Or busybody.
Chesterton famously says, it takes two to make a quarrel. The full potentialities of human fury cannot be fully realized until a friend tactfully intervenes.
That is, you know, for whatever situation, there's a Chesterton quote. It's just the way it works.
So anyway, when you get to, for example, one of the corporal works of mercy, which used to be, it was commonly looked on as a noble, good thing to do.
Yes.
Ransoming the captive.
Yes.
Well, we don't do that now. Because we do not negotiate with terrorists, you know, and all of that, right?
Right.
So if somebody takes somebody hostage, you know, if you ransom the captive, then you're seen as
weak. Soft
on terrorism and weak and et cetera, et cetera. You should go in with guns blazing and the rest of it. And there are arguments to be made for that, but the reason ransoming the captive was seen for so long as a work of mercy was because there was no powerful centralized state, no law enforcement, you know. So if Richard Lionheart gets taken captive on his way back from the Crusades, there's no
Yeah.
Negotiating body out there that's going to help him.
It's an act of mercy because you're giving to get some to help someone else, and it right, doesn't actually benefit you. You're making yourself poor.
From these bad guys, you know, there is no state that's going to help you. So because you're living, you know, for most of world history, you're living in more or less the Wild West, and it's like, you know, if somebody will help you out, then that's great, you know. And so even that shows how the Christian tradition, you know, bumps up against the changes in political situations and so on and so forth. And one of the things that was looked on with gratitude by the early Christians was the fact that they lived in a place that was not, like much of the world, just the Wild West.
Right, not random.
We'll talk about that when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti.
Hello.
And we will be back talking about our relationship with the state as Christians right after this. Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Sherry Antonetti.
Hello.
It's January, so the next big thing to happen, it will be, ironically, will be the
inauguration.
It'll be the, first of all, it will be Martin Luther King Jr. Day.
Yes.
And 3 days later, we will inaugurate a huge repudiation of everything that
the inauguration, I believe you're trying to say, but yes, okay.
So you laugh because
otherwise you'll cry.
So anyway, but when it comes to today, we're, you know, one of the things you run into, as I was mentioning before, I run into a lot of libertarians, you know, who really do have this kind of crazy anarchistic belief that the state should be, as was famously said by Grover Norquist, small enough to drown in a bathtub. And there's the disconnect between that and the fact that we live in the largest, most powerful, and
prosperous,
enormously industrialized, technological state.
Nation of the world, yeah.
The history of the world, and we should still be able to run that on, you know, the same principles, or not principles, but the same institutional organizations as existed in 18th century America. That's
no
something
tweaks.
Libertarians can believe, you know. It'll all just, you know, work all by itself, and there will be no state institution needed. And so I run into people, classic example. About a week ago, they announced that a 100% effective cure for Ebola has been created.
That's fabulous.
Isn't that amazing?
That is wonderful.
I mean, 2 years ago, people were absolutely terrified of this. I was seeing from some people, there was some, I don't know, Republican guy out in North Carolina who was seriously saying, we need to find every person who has Ebola and kill them.
Oh my
just
gosh.
Kill them and burn their bodies and, you know, and all the rest of it. And this was going to be...
That's like Black Plague kind of
thinking. Yeah, no kidding. It's just like, well, gee whiz, maybe we should accuse the Jews of poisoning wells while we're at it, you know? But it was, you know, that was going to be the solution for some of these people. And anyway, so there was this massive transnational effort that involved, of course, a huge push by the U.S. government, by the federal government, to coordinate this gigantic effort to find a cure for Ebola, to find a vaccine for Ebola. And thanks be to God, thanks to the hard work of these incredible people out there doing, you know, essentially doing, I don't know, some kind of, as far as I'm concerned, it's indistinguishable from magic. You know,
it's a montage of people with chemicals and in white gloves and magnifying glasses.
You know, all the rest of it. But anyway, they created a vaccine for Ebola. It's 100% effective. It's a gigantic achievement.
That's huge. That's magnificent.
Thanks be to God. So I put a note up saying, you know, note, libertarians, that this was not done by plucky guys with a chemistry set in their basement working by themselves without the interference of the state, that this was a state effort.
What was the response? I've got to know.
Resentment and anger. And essentially, they explained, shut up.
Oh.
And it was really amazing to see people whose ideology was so overwhelming for them. That a cure for Ebola was bad news.
That's just demented. That's just
it was demented, you know. But that's the thing. And what you find, of course, is when you move away from, you know, what libertarian is all ideology. It's a form of heresy. It's taken a single idea. In this case, the dignity of the individual, and has exalted it to this insane degree where it's pitted against all the rest of the Catholic tradition, including love of God and neighbor.
Yes.
And so when you move away from that and you start looking at common sense and looking at the actual teaching of the church, what you discover, one of the first things that you discover is Jesus is already, of course, acknowledging that the state is, it's a good. It's not the ultimate good. Right. When you make the state an ultimate good, that's just another form of idolatry. But neither is it just an unrelieved evil. Sure, the state is fallen like all things that participate in the human. But it's also a good thing. And so he says, render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. So pay your taxes.
Yes.
And render unto God that which is God's. And Paul will dilate on this in Romans 13. So he tells, and it's important to remember, it's really important to remember, that when Caesar's writing this, or when Paul is writing this, he's writing when Nero is Caesar.
Yeah, that's a big time, you know.
So it's important to note this. Paul is not calling us to limitless credulity to whatever the claims of the state are, because Paul knows that Nero is not a nice man. In fact, Nero will later murder Paul.
Right.
And it's vital to know, but nonetheless, he says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Therefore, he who resists the authorities resists what God has appointed, and those who resist will incur judgment. Yes, there are all kinds of ways to misread that text. You know, all of us are familiar
with
how the Nazis would have made use of a text like that. We all know what the Soviets did with a text like that.
That power cannot be abused does not mean that it isn't.
Right. Yeah.
Doesn't prove anything.
And so it's really vital to get that Paul says that, yes, he gets that the state can do evil. It was, after all, the state that put Jesus to death.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the state really does have a role from God. It really does do good things. And that given a choice between a state and anarchy, the Catholic tradition has always said,
state. Even, I mean, you know, Jesus didn't say, you know, Herod, really bad dude, shouldn't have been, you know, in power. He doesn't speak out about the slaughter of the innocents as being, you know, that Herod abused his power, but right, it wasn't true. That there shouldn't have been somebody in charge.
Yeah.
And that, you know, families sometimes abuse power. It doesn't mean that families are not good or that they're not better for one than being on one's own. It's not a case of it's not the institution itself that makes something fallen. It's the people in it misusing their authority in their power.
Yeah.
And that's what gets forgotten, I think, when people get either hyper trusting of the state or hyper distrusting of the state.
Yeah. And so Paul will go on and say that rulers are not a terror to good conduct, but to bad. Would you have no fear of him who is in authority, he says? Then do what's good, and you will receive his approval, for he's God's servant for your good. So most of the time, the reality still is that if you smash a store window and take somebody's stuff...
Yeah. That's bad.
Good thing to have the state there to stop you and make you give that guy's stuff back.
Yes.
And that's what the state is there to do. And so when even in a corrupt government, which is to say all governments.
Every government, yes.
It's still the case that if you are doing 60 miles an hour in a school zone,
and, you're in a bad spot.
And the cop pulls you over. Even if that cop is wearing a swastika armband, guess what? You still were doing 60 in a 30 mile an hour school zone and endangering people.
Children, yes.
And insofar as that is a legitimate law, the state has the right to prosecute you for doing that. And so that's. You know, that is basically Paul's approach. And that's Jesus' approach, of course, too. Jesus knows perfectly well that it's state authorities who are coming to him. Yes, he recognizes to try to nail him on the question of rendering taxes to Caesar. He knows that these people are bad people or have it in for them, but his or have it in for him. But his approach, nonetheless, is respect legitimate authority insofar as it is just law.
But I was going to say, this reminds me of, we saw Rogue One this weekend, and one of the things I saw was the theme of the just assassins, so to speak, that we are just because we are fighting something that is unjust, and our activities do not get called into question because we're trying to do something good. And then when the democratic process doesn't go their way, well, they follow their own conscience and go off to sacrifice themselves and bring everybody else around. But it's I sat there going, there's something, it's kind of a mythos of the just assassin bringing everyone else around to their point of view. And because we're all doing it for the right reason and we know the ending, these moral ambiguities can just be kind of waived by because we know what happens next.
The end's just one of the oldest arguments in the book. And yeah, everybody loves that one. The ends justify the means because I have a noble end in mind. I can do whatever evil thing I like. We'll talk about that when we return. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Sherry Antonetti talking about the relationship of the Christian and the state. And we'll be back right after this. are here today with Sherry Antonetti. We've been talking about the relationship of the Christian and the state, and all of that is prefaced to something that Sherry, you wrote, and I was wondering if you could sort of lay out your thoughts as we move into the problem of, you know, a period of time where we as Christians are, well, it's not a new problem, it's been a problem, but we as Christians are governed by somebody who in many ways, as the last administration has been, is opposed, deeply opposed to things that we believe.
Okay. Well, part of this brought up because there was a discussion of who's going to be praying at Trump's inaugural, and the question of how do you witness, you know, let's say you want to go to the inaugural because you're in D.C. or you want to go to pray for our country. How do you do that and not give rise to scandal by seeming to endorse values which you do not hold in any way, shape, or form, and at the same time participate in the public life? And living just outside of D.C., this is not an academic question for me or for anyone that I know. You know, if you go to an inaugural ball, that's looked at, you know, I've been to a couple, and sometimes I voted for the person and sometimes I haven't. And how do you, you know, but it looks like you're gung-ho if you go to an inaugural ball and you're dressed to the nines and you're there. So how do you go and give witness to what you believe authentically and participate in, say, the public life if, say, you happen to get invited to do something that would look, at least publicly, like it's giving endorsement or look like a scandal? Cardinal Dolan's going to be praying. Is that tacit to kind of the Catholic Church, the American Catholic Church, patting Trump on the back? I would argue no, but it's a real question which we have to wrestle with, because I don't think that everybody who either participates in the public life or who votes one way or the other is necessarily needing to go around wearing a scarlet H or a scarlet T, engage in self-flagellation in order to be able to talk about what they value. How do we authentically witness in this day and age? Mm-hmm. And that's the real question I was trying to get at, mm-hmm. Which prompted the beginnings of this conversation, which is, I love where you took it. So now here we are. Inauguration is coming up on the 20th. The schools here have off.
Oh, really?
Yes.
I guess that makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you do? Do you go down and just go sit in St. Matthew's and pray, you know, the rosary over and over again? Do you go and offer masses for our nation? What do you fast? What do you do in order to attempt to begin to live a public Catholic witness in this very secular administration?
I think with any administration, and, you know, Paul tells Timothy's a bishop that Paul has appointed, and so he's giving him instructions on how to bishop right.
Yes.
And when he writes to Paul in 1 Timothy, when Paul writes to Timothy in 1 Timothy chapter 2, he says, "First of all, then, I urge that supplications, prayers, intercessions, and thanksgivings be made for all men, for kings and all who are in high positions, that we Christians, may lead a quiet and peaceable life, godly and respectable in every way." He says, "This is good, and it is acceptable in the sight of God our Savior, who desires all men to be saved and to come to the knowledge of the truth." So Paul's point then is the health of the state is also something that coincides with the needs of the church. That when the state's not in anarchy and chaos and warfare and, you know, civil war and everybody's praying at each other's throats and all the rest
right.
of it, then we can get on with doing our Christian thing.
Yes.
That be afraid of getting killed in our own beds.
Yes. Go about your business, citizens, and pray for your nation and move on. Just keep
right.
doing, keep calm and Catholic on.
Yeah, exactly. And so when Paul's writing, Paul doesn't have, and the church has never had, any particular problem with people being patriots or good citizens. Patriotism is, in the church's understanding, it's just, it's one expression of the second greatest commandment, which is love of neighbor.
Yes. So I like that.
Yeah, and so patriotism is something that the church has always esteemed. Mm-hmm. What the church doesn't esteem especially is the thing that's a parody of patriotism, which is nationalism.
My country, right or wrong.
Right. So nationalism is to patriotism as pride is to self-love in an individual.
Good.
You can have healthy self-love, but the church says pride is the greatest sin.
And they're studying for SAT. That's an analogy.
Yeah. Yes. Nationalism can be, something that we've seen. The 20th century showed us what happened when nationalism becomes the greatest good, especially when German nationalism became a great good, became the highest good. But so Paul says, absolutely, you know, pray for the king. Pray for, you know, whoever's in authority over you. Because they are participating to one degree or another in the kingship of Christ. And if they do it well, then things will be really good. Things will be good in a lot of other ways, you know, if they do it well. If you participate in the kingship of the prince of this world, things don't go so well.
Yeah, as a rule. not so much. So
prayers for example, at an inauguration.
Right.
Sure. You know, fine, great. If any administration is ever going to need
prayers. Prayers and fasting.
Prayers, redemption, and the help of God, it's going to be this one. So that's fine. The question that always comes up is, are your prayers appearing to pronounce a kind of Jesus giving thumbs up to whatever the hell?
Yeah. Please endorse this candidate. No.
I'm Jesus of Nazareth and I endorse Donald Trump. You know, that's where things become problematic. And it's always a difficult issue trying to figure out whether what you're doing here is going to be seen as giving some kind of divine imprimatur.
Right.
To, you know, a bunch of crooks, or is this a sincere, is this an intercession for the prospering of the common good?
Yeah, I do love that people have been praying. There's been like a national call, I know that, to like pray like on Wednesdays in particular for our nation, and to fast on Wednesdays for our nation. And, you know, the way you know that that's earnest is because it doesn't benefit necessarily the person who's doing it, other than that, you know, to the extent that it spiritually strengthens them. But there's no, you know, they're not walking around wearing a sign saying, I'm fasting for my country. You know, they don't have a sticker or a ribbon or, you know, a bumper sticker. They're just doing it.
Yes. Behold my holiness. So that's always the tricky thing. And, you know, how you navigate that, you know, there are people, I waffle back and forth. My impression was, and it was just an impression, was that, you know, Catholic clergy have always shown up at things like presidential inaugurations.
Yes.
Which it turned out wasn't true. There hasn't been any Catholic clergy at an inauguration in the last 40 years.
Really? I didn't know that.
That was news to me. So it turns out that Cardinal Dolan's going to go to this one. And it's like, I go back and forth on it. You know, on the one hand, I don't want, I know in my bones, I know that Trump is going to be a catastrophe for this country, and also that he's going to be a catastrophe for Christians who have so closely identified themselves with him, because that's not going to be forgotten. People will see that Christians identified themselves with him closely, and when it turns out to be a catastrophe, it's going to be too late then to say, oh, I'm not even standing next to the guy.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing is that we're going to be tarred and feathered as Christians with whatever guilt by association. And that's going to be a problem. And,
right. Peter's advice to Christians all in times of persecution, he never says, fight back, right? He tried right. that.
Yeah, and, got told no.
It didn't work. And admittedly, you know, there is a place for self-defense and all the rest of it. But it's notable that you don't see it in the New Testament.
Yes.
Peter's advice to persecuted Christians is, well, be sure to die well. Don't die because you actually were a jerk who deserved
it. Be sure to die well.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah,
that's really striking, you know, that and Peter will live that out. Peter himself will go to a martyrdom under Nero.
Right.
You know, so what the churches are, what Jesus always warns the church against is not persecution. He warns it against seduction.
Comfort. That's the biggest danger, I think, to Christianity is when we are comfortable. Yeah. So here is an opportunity with the inauguration to make Christianity great on your soul again.
There you go.
That's the goal.
All right. Well, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today, Sherry. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer today was the indefatigable Danny Head. And we will be back tomorrow. Until then, have a grand new year. Bye-bye.
Happy New Year. Bye-bye.